Come and listen to the first special episode, a conversation with Dr. Argel, who I met through the Society of Neuroscience conference, which happened about a month ago. We talk about his journey into neuroscience and his work covering memory and studies into neuroinflammation and the use of ketamine. This is the first of two special episodes from researchers who I contacted through the recent Society of Neuroscience virtual conference, which had over 10,000 attendees. It was a great event. I learned so much science. And even then, I only was able to look at a small section of it. But I wanted to share the stories and the research from some scientists to show you how diverse science actually is. Hi, Arjel. Could you just tell me a little bit more about yourself?
I was born and raised in Mexico. I was born in Mexico City, but I was raised in the southern part of the country, which is close to the border with Guatemala. I grew up in a very small town. Through school, I don't necessarily had anything special about science. It was a regular basic curriculum that a public university in Mexico can offer you. Mm-hmm. But luckily, my father had a huge personal library. Mm-hmm. Just were in humanities, but he had a few science books. I found it intriguing. So I remember when I didn't have a strong preference for anything in the equivalent to high school, just before going to university, when you have to decide, oh, what do I want to study? Mm-hmm. And I was torn between, for some reason, biology and history. The history part, it was more obvious because, again, my house was filled with humanities book history. I, you know, like many people, like ancient history is just fascinating.
Yep. Right? Which ancient history?
Anything before the European Middle Ages.
You're exactly the same as me. That's exactly the same as me.
Oh, I'm not familiar with a lot of, Far East cultures, but like, you know, Near East, Southern Europe, like the Americas, it's fascinating. Well, Aaron, I will call in our continent, you know, before the Spanish, the English, and the French came.
Okay, yeah.
that's what I call ancient history for our country. Anyhow, so I just was debating between the two, and then I decided biology just because it sounded a little bit of a more potentially. I will have a better time finding a job eventually.
Yeah.
That's what I figured. Little did I know. Anyhow, but I started general biology and it was really interesting. I was quickly introduced to microbiology and molecular biology in the first year. I found my molecular biology fascinating. I was immediately in love with it. And the person who was teaching me that happened to be a neuroscientist who... She was a researcher, but she had helped to design that part of our program. And she wanted to teach it at least once to see how it worked. And through her, I connected with neuroscience research. And that's how it all started. Towards the end of my undergrad, I was doing some work in her lab. We have to do a small thesis work for our undergrad. So yeah. I did it with her. And then I did a master's degree in her lab, and
what was it on your master's? Was it an expansion of your undergrad, or was it something else?
Yeah, so they were working on this neuropeptide TRH, which is in the hypothalamus. It controls the release of TSH, and then thyroid, and in turn TSH controls thyroid hormones. So they were studying the regulation, the regulation of the expression of these. Of this peptide in different circumstances, like exposure to cold, which is an obvious thing where the thyroid axis will get activated. But then there have been reports for many years that it was like many things nowadays, we know it's expressed in many more places and so it probably plays many more roles. So we started looking, it was particularly expressing places like the hippocampus and the amygdala again. Express everything. But it was sort of like the initial question is like, well, is it involving some of the functions that these regions normally are more classically associated with? So I was focusing on memory. So we were looking at if it's regulated during the acquisition of spatial memory tasks, like the Morris-Waterman's. So we studied its regulation, and the idea was to then knock it down to see if it affected learning or not. I didn't get to that part. Initially, I wanted to do my PhD there, but I applied. I was still in the master's. I needed to what they call a sort of like a fast track into the PhD. I applied to that, and then you have to do some sort of defense. So you have to present your what you want to do as a PhD student in front of a committee, and then the committee will question everything.
See what they want to give you the money.
It was quite an intense experience, and they decided that I was not fit for the job. So they turned me down. And you know, I always tell my students, rejection is part of this career. Yeah. We apply for so many things, and most of them, we will not get them. So that was my first big taste of rejection. But I also had the idea of going outside of Mexico to do something. That I had that in my mind. I always liked to travel, and I when I was younger, I didn't really have the chance to travel. So I figured, well, this is a great opportunity to do some of that. And I started applying other places because I already had almost completed the master's at that point. I didn't want to go to, you know, the US system where you have to do like 2 years of only courses. And then your research comes after, and whether you have a master's or not, it doesn't matter. I didn't want to fall into that. And also my English wasn't great. So you know, you have to do all of these standardized tests for the U.S. school theory and the I can't remember the other one. It just seemed a bit daunting. So I started looking in place in Germany. Where was I looking?
UK? In
the UK, I looked a bit. And then I also looked in Canada. And Sweden. There was a lab in Sweden I really wanted to go. But apparently international students, the way it was explained to me was too complicated for the way they need to pay the students. So eventually I found a lab in Canada that took me in and offered me, you know, the job, and I accepted. It was an area, a bit of a different area. It was more on neuroinflammation. So I came here to start a PhD. It was a great experience. It was at McGill University in Montreal. First thing, I really was not expecting to. I've heard that there was some French in Canada. I've heard that in Montreal, some people were bilingual. And I was like, okay, sounds great. Sounds cool. But when I came here, I did not expect that the whole province was really Francophone. And outside Montreal, it will be communities that don't speak. And well, at least they don't want to speak it, don't speak a lot of English. So that was the first big thing I realized. But anyway, it was a very interesting experience. I didn't know I was going to stay here for as long as I stayed. And I had a great time at PhD. It was a very supportive environment. The lab mates were great. My supervisor was great.
What was the PhD project on exactly?
Right. On understanding the basis of regulation of fever in inflammation settings, but from the central nervous system perspective, and identifying the role of different inflammatory cytokines and new hormones that had been discovered to have a role in inflammatory responses, such as leptin, which is, you know, we know about leptin because of regulation of appetite, but he's discovered that it also was involved in the inflammatory response to infectious agents. Mm-hmm. So I was put in actually a bit of a different project because around that time, there were many reports on clinical studies that have associated maternal infections with the development of psychiatric disorders such as schizophrenia in the offspring. It was a very new area. The link had just been reported in a couple of clinical studies. So because of his expertise in inflammation, he started working on inflammation models during gestation and then looking at what happened in the offspring. So that's where the project I went into. And well, it's an area that has grown like drastically now. There is there's reports of it being also a risk factor for autism spectrum disorders and cerebral palsy and a couple of other neurodevelopmental disorders. So it's a field that's grown since quite dramatically. We were some of the first people looking in and trying to model in rodents and trying to identify what part of the inflammatory response of the mother was altering the development of the brain. Mm-hmm. We focused a lot on the dopaminergic system, as it had been reported to be a risk factor for schizophrenia. So, yeah. So it was a lot of fun. It was the first time I was doing behavior in rats. It was really cool. I still do quite a bit of behavior, and then it was combined with some molecular biology, some biochemistry. So
what did your results show from your PhD, and did that lead on to what you're doing now, or are you currently working on something different?
Yes and no. It's different. But anyway, I'll explain in a minute. So we found, first objective was to try a different model. The model hasn't caught on necessarily, but it is still fun. I have fond memories of it. So it's a localized aseptic inflammatory stimulus. Basically, you inject turpentine to the hind leg of the animal that produces local edema, local inflammation. But inflammation is not a local phenomenon. Inflammation is a systemic phenomenon. So you have release of cytokines through the body in the bloodstream, like this surge. And if you do that in a pregnant rat, then you sort of have a sustained inflammatory response that lasts for, I will say, about 12 hours. Whereas with the other models, you usually inject the lipopolysaccharide or LPS,
yep,
which is a wall component, or poly-IC, which is a double-stranded mRNA molecule. It's small, it's like an oligo, but it mimics some viral infections where double-stranded RNA is generated during the replicative cycle of viruses. Anyhow, so these, and they last for a couple of hours, and then they usually clear from the body. It's not a real infection, you just adding some activates the immune system, but it's quickly cleared. Whereas this one, because it's necrotic damage of the tissue, the animal is in a state of inflammation for a bit longer. Mm-hmm. So we figure it might give us more consistent results than the other models. And it did. And also, like the other models, you can have fetal mortality. So obviously rats are multiparous, so they have up to, sometimes 14 pups at the same time. But with LPS and poly-IC, in many cases, they were observing that the litter size was reduced. So there was some mortality. The model that wasn't happening because basically what was in the circulation of the mother is inflammatory mediators from the mother, not the molecule. No. So from a practical perspective, it seemed a bit better. But obviously, model for inflammation, but not a model for infection. So that distinction becomes a bit important when you're trying to model. Anyhow, what we found is that the pups, the offspring of these mothers, had hyperactive dopaminergic system. So you challenge them with vitamin, usually that makes the animals hyperactive. And in the offspring of mothers that had the infection were even more hyperactive. We looked at the dopaminergic system, the terminal regions of the dopaminergic neurons in the nucleus accumbens seemed to be, we saw an increase in the levels of a marker of the terminals there. So indicating development of these terminals was somehow altered in a way that they had more of these terminals there. So potentially explaining the hyperactive phenotype. And then we focused on trying to reverse these phenotypes, the behavioral and molecular phenotypes. So we blocked a couple of cytokines, such as interleukin-6, but also we blocked leptin, which is favorite molecule of my supervisor. Mm-hmm. And both surprisingly reversed the effects of maternal inflammation. So after that, I did two postdoctoral trainings. I first went to the States, to the US, to do more epigenetic molecular research. So I found a lab that her PI's name is Court Miller. She works, she's a researcher at the Grief Research Institute the original one is in California, but they opened a new one in Florida. So we went there for a little over a year working on the role of enzyme that removes methyl groups from histones, so histone methylation, in the formation of maladaptive memories linked to the consumption of methamphetamine. So it was more in the drug addiction field. So it was a bit of a switch. It was still the dopaminergic system, but it was related to something else. And then for a number of reasons, we decided to come back to Canada. It was me and my wife, and at that point, we already had a kid. So I started looking for labs, and I found, well, my wife's also a scientist, so in more basic biochemistry. So her PhD was on protein structure. So she's one of those people that crystallizes proteins and then, mutates different parts of protein and looks at the effects on structure and function. I was not intending necessarily to go back to Montreal, but we found a lab, actually one lab in Montreal, that was doing both, was doing basic biochemistry and was also doing neuroscience. His name is, the researcher is Nahum Sonnenberg. And he's well-known scientist that works on regulation of mRNA translation and initiation. So I was a new field, but still linked to gene expression, obviously, which was something that from the beginning I was interested on. And he was doing some neuroscience research. So it's okay, let's go. And at the time, he was mostly working on neurodevelopmental disorders, autism spectrum disorder. And so I had some experience, obviously, with my PhD work on some, at least some aspects of neurodevelopment or modifying some aspects of neurodevelopment. So I think it was, it's sort of like in line, but not really. Depends how you present it.
Yeah.
But still, it was it was a very interesting field. So a lot of the genes that regulate mRNA translation, not a lot, a large number of genes that regulate mRNA translations are mutated in cases of autism spectrum disorder. So there is a strong link between the two there. So I started working a bit on a couple of those projects, trying to actually use a mouse model, a mutant mouse model for one of these factors, trying to reverse the phenotypes in the adults to see if there was some potential for treatment. We were using, at the time, it was something that was widely used, is metabotropic glutamate antagonists. So we're being used for fragile X. It even went on to phase 3 clinical trials for fragile X. It didn't work in phase 3. There were promising results in phase 1 and 2. But it turns out it was not as good for phase 3. Actually, it was a big blow in the field because it was the preclinical evidence was clear. Any mouse model of Fragile X syndrome and any Drosophila model that they tried them on, it reversed most old phenotypes that they looked at, behavioral, molecular, etc. And then the first two trials reported promising results, but when they went to phase 3, that's where things just went south. They did some analysis later on, and apparently in some patients, my work, but not in all, obviously the pharma industry at the time, it's changing a bit because personalized medicine has become something more of a of a thing these days, but back then it was still let's try to find a cure for as many people as possible. So it's sort of like a blow in the field at the time, for particularly for finding treatments for developmental disorders. Again, several years have passed and things are changing and people are going back at it, but for a while it sounds like the pharma industry is not going to go to it anymore because of this big disappointment, but whatever. Things keep changing. So when I was there, I also started working on psychiatric disorders and depression models, etc. Started to investigate the role of these translation regulators, mRNA translation regulators, in some behaviors that are relevant for depression. And then came ketamine, which is when I was a couple of years before I joined that lab, it was shown that it regulates this process, mRNA translation. What we started looking more specifically is whether these proteins, the specific proteins that regulate translation, were involved in the antidepressant response. Okay. So that's sort of it's the basis of my current work. I'm a big line of my lab. It's looking into the mechanism of action of ketamine, digging deeper into the mechanism of action of ketamine, trying to find at least as effective ways of treat depression, particularly, you know, those cases that don't respond to first line treatments like SSRIs and such, which is a large chunk of people.
Yeah, a lot of them, because I have read a lot about ketamine being used for psychiatric conditions.
So yeah, the need arises because of that, as you said, like there is like 30 to 40% of people diagnosed with major depressive disorder that won't respond to SSRIs, SNRIs, MAO inhibitors, etc., like the typical antidepressant. But a few years ago, like people found that sub-anesthetic dose of ketamine is used as an anesthetic, is still used at least in Canada as a veterinary anesthetic. But even in the clinic, it's still, I think, for pediatric surgeries, is one of the anesthetics that they use. But at sub-anesthetic doses, it gave a very strong and very rapid, within hours, these people were already had this depression scores lowered. So it's been a change in the psychiatry field, and then we're looking into what does it do molecularly? What are the essential elements that ketamine activates in the brain that will be required to elicit and to have an antidepressant response? That's what we're trying to find. Because as all drugs, it's not a perfect drug. There is the potential for abuse. It can have some actually psychomimetic effects. Like that means like mimic some aspects of psychosis or schizophrenia. Actually, for the longest time, I remember before it became like really popular for as an antidepressant. Before that, basic researchers like me were using it to model schizophrenia as well. So I knew it because of that. So when I found out it was using antidepressant, I'm like, wait a minute. In the clinic, you know, like not everything is, you know, black and white. So there are some people at higher risk of showing this, you know, particular people with his family history of psychotic disorders, some signs of psychosis through their lifetime. Those people wouldn't be eligible. Well, in theory, they shouldn't be eligible for ketamine therapy because it could exacerbate potentially those unmask those risk factors. And then that's the damage is greater than the benefit. So it still needs to be a bit tailored, and it's not given to everybody, but it's quite effective.
Your research into ketamine, would that allow for more effective ketamine-like drugs to be developed? Is that what you're trying to go with this research?
Yeah, that is the goal. There's a couple of pharma companies that are working on that, like finding their approach is modify the ketamine molecule and then tests for antidepressant effects in rodents first, obviously, and also like the other effects that are not the side effects, and they're trying to improve the antidepressant response and reduce the other side or make it longer lasting or things like that. Our approach is more, we treat the mice with ketamine and then go into their brains and find molecular changes and then test whether those molecular changes are required for the effect of ketamine, and then maybe potentially find ways to engage those same pathways, but without necessarily using ketamine. So it's a bit of a different approach. It's a bit of a longer route, perhaps. But I think just knowing how this thing works, it's really like something like ketamine works as an antidepressant. I think it's fundamental to be able to, you know, post, like, if you don't know how exactly works, you don't know necessarily how to avoid the bad things or how to, you know, how to potentiate the good thing. So that's what we're trying to do there. It's a bit of a longer, you know, path. It's not going to immediately tell us, oh, you have to use this in scanning. But okay. I think we're making some progress.
And what animal models do you normally use? Is it mice, rodents, I guess, so mice and rats?
We're using rodents, and some work is done in just what we call naive rodents. Just your rodent living in a cage, and then you take it, you give it ketamine, and then you look at the behaviors and then molecularly. Mm-hmm. But then that might not necessarily be relevant for depressive disorders. So to make it more clinically relevant, what we do is we we chronically stress the mice. So chronic stress is a risk factor for major depressive disorder. So basically, for several weeks, we go in and then we do something to the mice. We remove their bedding. Okay. We tilt their cages. Yeah. Their bedding, we put some water so it's wet. It's not soaking wet, but it's still wet and uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. We sometimes restrain them. We put them in a very narrow tube, and then for 10 minutes, but that's a stress for mice. We put them to swim, which is not, swimming is not in itself is not stressful unless you never encounter water in your life in that large volume, and then you're suddenly put that. So mice, I don't like the word, but they're innate swimmers. They don't drown, like unlike humans, right? We learn how to swim, but we're not innate swimmers. Mm-hmm. If they throw you for the first time in the water, it's more likely you will drown. But rodents are not like that. Even lab rodents have never swam in their lives. You put them in water and they swim. Mm-hmm. And also they float easier than us. Rats are much better swimmers than mice. They're stronger and they're half. But anyhow, it's still a stressor. So we give them in a pseudo-random order. Like we change the order of the stressors through the five-week period that we every day. And then at the end, they have some behavioral changes that are reminiscent of depression. They are not interested, for example, in a sugary drink. We give them water with sucrose, and they're not as interested in that. So that is thought to be related to something that we observe in humans, which is anhedonia, which is the lack of or the inability to derive pleasure from things that in other circumstances will give you pressure. We also look for self-grooming behavior, which is something that mice normally do. In these chronically stressed mice, they stop doing it. So it's like sort of like a bit of, some people call it a measure of self-care. It's hard to judge that this is self-care, but it's something that mice do. And it's a behavior that is changing different stress conditions. So get that as well, and then treat them with ketamine. And then we have some mice that are deficient in some of these, they're mutant mice for some of the proteins that are involved in the translation regulation, the mRNA translation. And we look at how these mice respond to stress as well. How do they respond to ketamine in these circumstances of chronic stress and so on and so forth. Then we look into their brains for different things like synaptic proteins, how are they changed, particularly in the hippocampus again. It's a region that is very sensitive to the effects of chronic stress. And we know that from, from research through many years, and even in humans, we know there's like the hippocampus is a large target of the stress hormones. So when you're stressed and all that, there's a lot of stress hormone receptors in your hippocampus. It will be a big target. So we look there what happens to, synaptic proteins. Usually with chronic stress, like things are reduced, and then these rapidly acting antidepressants like ketamine will bring it back. And then we know that certain molecular pathway is important for that, because if we have a mutant mouse for that pathway, first of all, they don't develop all these alterations by stress and so on and so forth. So that's more or less what we're trying to do. We're working also with a couple of small companies here in Canada, they're looking at other molecules that have also potential antidepressants. So we're trying to figure out if that's the case. We're trying to test them in rodents again, these models, and then see if they work. And then if they work, how are they doing to the brain of these mice that make them an antidepressant? So that's something we're actively working on.
And what other research are you doing in your lab, is apart from the ketamine research?
Right. So we're still working on some models of neurodevelopmental disorders. That's something I still like. So again, there's been like a huge the investigating the genetic basis of autism spectrum disorders has been like a booming field in recent years, and they've identified a number of genes. Well, the number is it's a bit high. It's close to 100, but it's not, you know, it's not out of control. And about 100 or so genes are derived from genome-wide studies. So they were looking at the whole genome of people with ASD. And also they've done it in very large cohorts. So it's not like the older genetic studies where they will look at specific, you know, single nucleotide polymorphism in 20 patients, and then they find some link, and then nobody is able to replicate the link. So the huge difference is now the scale of it. Like, your people are able to look at genome wide for starters, and second, now you have very large cohorts that have been studied. So these hundreds or so genes that have been identified through these studies are what they, well, we refer to as high confidence genes. So they've been verified and in several cohorts, and then obviously the techniques are much better. So we are confident they're linked. And what they reveal is, you know, autism is, well, we know that autism is a heterogeneous disorder. All psychiatric disorders, all neurodevelopmental disorders are very different from one to another. And they're, most of them are polygenic. So the idea of finding a couple of genes that explain most cases, it's gone. It's been discarded. Well, now we know that many people, there are actually an accumulation of mutations that sort of like each of them, it has a very little increment in the risk, but then when combined, you have a higher risk.
It leads
There's
to,
interactions yeah. with. Yeah, exactly. It leads to this. It's like perhaps a threshold you can think of. You need to have to reach that threshold. And then even, you know, that's sort of like a arbitrary clinical threshold, because, you know, you have a great range of people that are diagnosed with ASD, and then basically can follow a regular life, and some of them will need assistance, so like through the whole life. It's a very like huge spectrum, so we know that the definition isn't great. People are working on that, I suppose. So we're trying to understand some of those newly identified genes. What do they do to brain development? So we're looking, again, mutating them in mice and looking at their brains, what is changing, and then how does that impact the mouse's behavior. And then that's sort of like the first approach in some of them. And then in other cases where we have more information about what they're doing, we're trying to reverse the effects on that. Well, treat rather than reverse, I would say. Treat the effects of those genes. Now, I don't know if we will be able to reverse with the approaches we're using, but I mean, there's now lots of labs that are working on like that, trying to treat ASD. So hopefully it'll result in some therapies that some children might benefit in the not so distant future.
And what future work are you thinking of? Are you thinking of staying in these areas, or are you going to expand to any other areas of research?
Because I only started my research lab in January 2019, so 3 years, almost 3 years ago. So for now, these are the two areas we're working on. Probably it will change in a few years when some of these projects are finished, and then yeah, we will have to then reassess what do we pursue after our initial findings. Do we stay on the same? I suspect some of these projects will be like, you know, shorter term, like we find maybe something or not on nothing at all, and then we switch over. But some of the projects might last a bit longer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And regarding the area you're in, what advice would you give to students who want to come into this area of research of neurodevelopmental and neuropsychiatric disorders?
I think in general, for all like, you know, science students, there is no right or set path to get into anything. When I talked about my going into science and my interest in biology, I was not interested at all in disease per se or mental disorders. I was coming more from a very basic perspective, like basic science perspective. And I never intended to go, but when I went into the PhD, again, my intention is neuroscience, that's like basic neuroscience. That's what I want to know. I want to know how the brain works, kind of. The lab I went, well, the focus of research in different countries varies a little bit. And in Canada, perhaps in the States and the UK, there is a lot of the research is really focused on understanding the basis of illnesses. So even though the lab had interest in, you know, basic neurobiology and neuroinflammation processes, they have an implication for psychiatric disorders. So that's sort of like how I got involved into it. Unless you have a very huge interest in these fields, you might encounter them anyway in your path, because they've grown exponentially and they're almost in every university, they will have somebody working on that. And if you have the chance from your undergrad, try to get involved in research to find out what it is, what it requires, how it's done. There are some programs, depending on the university, there are some programs that will allow students during summer months or something like that to work in a lab and get compensated. If you have the means and the time, you can also volunteer in a lab. These volunteers are not being paid, so it's great. It's not a great system. But at least for trying something new while you're doing your studies, you can get involved into that. Again, it just gives you an idea of what it is, what it requires to do. And then obviously, if your program requires doing a thesis work and all that, then you can get into. But this idea of trying different labs, trying different things, I think it's fundamental, because there's many aspects to the research that we do. There are clinical research labs that work directly with patients. And that's something that if you want to work on these disorders, that's another option that you have. So if you're in a place where there's different types of labs are, again, working a little bit on each of those labs through your undergraduate program will help you figure out what type of research. Even if you're interested in psychiatric disorders, there's many types of research. You will be working in animal models, or do you want to be working more directly with patients? So trying things around and helping you define what do you want, I think it's important. And then there's more formal opportunities, like doing a graduate degree, a master's or a diploma or something that give you even more exposure to research. But even before that, now there's, you know, people start volunteering or getting into labs early, and that helps you to define your career path.
This is a question I like asking just to get to know more about the non-science side of scientists is, what do you do in your free time apart from science?
I don't have a lot of free time. I have two kids. I have two young kids. So I mostly these days do stuff that will be interesting for them. Mm. I love reading. I'm not a very active person, basically. So I love reading. So when I have the chance and not doing, we'll try reading. And lately I've been reading a lot of science dissemination work, but I used to love reading fiction. Well, I still do. I just don't do it as often as I used to.
You kind of preempted my next question, which was going to be, what book are you currently reading? So,
oh, I have here. It's called The Book of Humans. I didn't know that, but is he a British author? Yes, he is. Alan Rutherford. Can't remember where he works. In a couple of. And it's on genetics, it's human genetics, but, you know, put in a context of more, a bit of anthropological context.
The only book I've kind of read like that is, have you read Homo Sapiens by Yuval?
But this is more genetics, so because he's a geneticist.
Okay.
So it has more of that angle. I suppose the other one is more like anthropology, history. Another author I read recently, the book is called The Silk Roads.
Yep, I've read that. That's a brilliant book.
It became a huge book, but I loved it too. And there is a second part to it. It was really interesting. But obviously that's not, that's not a different type of science. And that perspective about learning about all, using this like idea of the Silk Road just to introduce all the different cultures. I think that's brilliant.
Fiction book?
Oh, lately I was reading an author. She's Mexican like me, so I would, but she lives in Canada like me, so maybe that's why it drew me to her. She writes in English, which I found very, I love the idea. Because, you know, in this in this continent, the idea of our language is Spanish, English, French, not the original language from here, right? So this idea that you have to stick to a language, to me, like, you know, it's like if you're a Mexican author, you will only accept it, to write in Spanish. But the fact that she goes against that, I found it fascinating. Like the fact that she's talking about, because she's Mexican, she knows our culture. She's talking about it, and but it's in English. It's not a translation. It's originally written in English. Anyhow, but she writes like very, but there are some of them are more like a bit of fantasy, horror, and it incorporates a lot of like cultural elements from Mexico. So I the book,
I read fiction and like history books, is a wide range of stuff, but I've always loved fantasy. Like, have you ever read Lord of the Rings?
I did read Lord of the Rings. I read it in English, so know if my English was like, so the way he writes,
it's different.
It's different, and it's from a time, so I'm not that familiar with some of the way the language is used. So it creates a bit of a problem for me. I tried The Hobbit and I just couldn't start it. And I know it's a book and it's supposed to be a children's book. And I just like, I can't, there's something here I don't get.
Do you normally read books in English or Spanish? Or?
Well, because I'm living here, I don't have access to a huge range of, I tend to read in English. But when I ever go to Mexico, I'll just try to get a couple of books in Spanish.
Which do you prefer? Like, do you find it more comfortable to read in Spanish?
Now I'm more used to reading in English. So it sort of improves over time. The more you do it, the easier it becomes. So now I feel quite, yeah. But when I was reading Lord of the Rings, it was a couple of years after I started my PhD. I did it in Spanish. I know many people that read it in Spanish, but I was not that familiar with him. I remember in university people were talking about it, and I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I like this. But then when I came here, I went through it and I enjoyed it. But at the beginning, I remember there were parts like, I don't understand what this is. Oh, it's very different. The big difference with virtual conferences is you're not really focused on the conference. You're kind of listening to a few things, but you know your other things. And then sometimes you have to be doing other things. Mm. Your attention is split. And I think that's just, it doesn't work. I don't become normalized that you can talk to people and present your work through, you know, Zoom like now. Talk to people in very different, like very far away places without needing to travel. That's an advantage. But a whole conference virtual, I still find it difficult. I will go to a couple of things and then the rest I just skipped it because, well, first of all, you're not forced to drop everything else or you're not in dropping everything else to go to the conference, which it helps to again to focus. I like the idea of lectures, like virtual lectures, but conferences I'm not that fond of. At the same time, you know, and the idea that we will go back to the way it was, I think it's not very realistic. First off, I don't think our environment can support the level of air traveling that we've been doing. So the fact that there are other options out there, I think it's great. Also, you know, like scientists with kids and all that, they always had a harder time, you know, traveling around. And I think this virtual events facilitate. So there is like, I think finding some balance will help. But this idea of sort of replicating the type of schedule that you have in a in-person conference in a virtual environment, I don't think it works. I think it needs to be done differently, shorter hours, because really you can't, I mean, you can be sitting in a computer, in front of a computer for 8 hours straight. Like,
that's just not healthy
to begin with. Yeah, no. So I think we need to work on redefining the way these virtual conferences are. They're not meant to be the same thing, and they're not. So it should be different. But yeah, I appreciate the fact that we now are talking and presenting our work people without needing to travel. I think that's great on its own, but not for a full day conference. That's, you know, that's a big difference. And then the idea of travel time, going to different places, it used to be one of the big pluses going to research career, yeah. Right? Like, there's very few perks, but this one, it was
this is one of them, like the travel.
We need to find some balance. But yeah, meeting with people that you've known for years, but now they move to other places, that's lost to, well, for now, at least. Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see how it comes back and what happens.
Well, it's been great talking to you. You've given me a lot of new information, which is interesting. We talked about so much, so hopefully the summary will help. I know it'll help me. We started with his journey into science. We started through books. Books are such an important thing. They open us up to new worlds. That is why I love them so much, because they can teach us so much. He built on his interest, doing an undergraduate degree, then a master's degree, and then a PhD. But the PhD required him to move around. And he did go to Toronto, which he eventually has returned to now and is working there. He's worked on many interesting models. One, which I found very interesting, was his inflammation model, which used low tissue damage. And this led to, in my opinion and his, a much more accurate model, because current models that use injecting proteins from viruses or bacteria don't replicate what we find in a human or in any animals during infection or injury that effectively. And the effects are normally very short term when you inject the protein. When you do local tissue damage, the model can be used for a much longer period of time. He has also done research into the effect of maternal rat infection. So that means what effect it has if the mother gets infected while she's pregnant and what effect that has on the offspring. We're finding this is having a major effect on the development of offspring. I'm mainly interested in the gut microbiome and how that can be affected in this manner, but there are many other ways. He also gave me quite a few good book recommendations. The one I'm definitely going to chase up is Gods of Jade and Shadow by Silvia Morano Garcia. I've never really read authors from South America, so this will be interesting. His advice to also explore your interests is really good, because a lot of the time, and especially with New Year coming, we should be exploring our interests. Don't forget to check out the links and other interesting description to learn more. If someone you know wants to come on the podcast, then get in touch. Be sure to share the podcast as well and comment if you liked it. I welcome constructive feedback. Emphasize on constructive, because I do want to improve this podcast. And be sure to check out my podcast website. I also have a blog, which I'll be filling with recent exciting research, because there's too much to just have on these podcast episodes where I just highlight one paper, which I think is the main highlight in a month. But my blog will let you look at papers, a more diverse array of papers. With that, it's the end of the special episode number 1, or episode 9. And I look forward to exploring another paper, bringing to light the majestic contents of the brain.